This meeting is now being live streamed. This is Value After Hours. I'm Tobias Carlyle, joined as always by my co-host Jake Taylor. Our special guest today is Jim Carroll. He is with Ballast Rock Private Wealth. He's a senior wealth advisor and portfolio manager. He's the Vixologist on Twitter. How are you, Jim? Good to see you.
I'm very well, thank you. Appreciate it.
Welcome, Jim.
Jim, you sent me through. You did a review of what happened in the VIX and volatility last year. Let's start there. Why don't we just start off at a very rudimentary level? Let's talk about first what volatility VIX is, and then let's proceed into it from there, if you don't mind.
Sure. No, not at all. So VIX is a measure of S&P 500 implied volatility going out 30 days. So it's looking out 30 days into the future, and it's essentially taking a strip of S&P 500 index options, both puts and calls, and measuring the implied volatility of those options and then collapsing that into one number for VIX. And, you know, what people colloquially know about VIX is that it is the fear index, right? VIX jumps when things get bad, and VIX tends to drop when things are calm. It's a little more nuanced than that. There's kind of an ecosystem that has been built up around VIX. VIX goes back to about 1993. It's gone through a couple of computation changes to kind of keep up with the modern world. You know, what people think about when they think about VIX is fear and, you know, what's happening in the market. Is it calm? Is everything okay? Or is it agitated and, you know, things are maybe upside down? It's become even more complicated over time because, you know, somebody said, well, gee, you know, if we have a 30-day measure of implied volatility, why don't we have a 60-day measure of implied volatility? Why don't we go out 3 months and 6 months and a year? And you can actually create a term structure of volatility from these different SIBO indices. And now we've gone all the way down to zero, because obviously 0 day to expiration options are, you know, all the rage these days. So we've created this ecosystem, and another part of that, another important part of that, going back to 2004, was the introduction of VIX futures. So we have an array of VIX futures and then VIX options that actually trade to the futures, not to the spot index. So there's a lot to get confused about, and people are routinely confused about, you know, what to do with these things, and, you know, why is this one going one direction and that one's going a different direction? And so it makes life fun for me on Twitter because I can jump in and try to confuse people even more.
Hey, Jim, does a 0 day, does that, you know, we've heard about how that has this gamma issues that for regular stocks, but does that do anything to the VIX side as well?
Well, there's been a lot of
hedging.
Yeah, there's been a lot of back and forth on that in the VIX world, you know, VIX Voltwit, if you will, because if you think about it, if you're managing a portfolio, and one of the things you do is you use options to either hedge the portfolio, or maybe, you know, one of the hot topics these days is whether some people are out there using call options as stock replacement, right? I don't want to own in NVIDIA anymore, but I don't want to lose my exposure to it. So I'll sell my underlying stock, but I'm going to buy some call options. So if it keeps going, I can participate. And with the, you know, you go back and there were monthly option expirations. And then they said, gee, well, if monthly's good, weekly's got to be better. And so, you know, the big indices got weekly options, and eventually some of the big single stocks got weekly options. Well, if weekly options are good, so then you had every other day in S&P, and now we've got every day. So every day is a zero data expiration option opportunity. And if you think about it, you say, well, gee, you know, it used to be that if I wanted to hedge against some known event on the calendar, I'd have to go out past it and, you know, express my hedge, you know, out 30 days or more. And now I can say, okay, boom, next Tuesday, you know, I'm hedged. And so the question really becomes, are some of these flows coming down into the shorter expiry periods, and is it sucking activity out of, you know, the 30-day VIX calculation? You know, is VIX broken? Oh, let's go through that again. And I would argue that, you know, VIX ain't broken. It's as, you know, either useful or useless as it's ever been. The options out there still trade. People still use it as a, you know, measure of what's going on with implied volatility relative to realized volatility and relative to other things. But clearly, the activity at the front end of the expiry structure is a different thing. It's a new thing. And clearly, it's having impact, really, at least so far, more on a day-to-day basis than, you know, in the bigger picture of where things are going to go 3 or 6 months from now. Because dealers obviously have to be in the market. They're buying and selling these things. And you know, if you listen to the experts who are, you know, in the pits dealing with this stuff, the only way to hedge as a dealer, the only way to hedge zero DTE is with zero DTE.
So they're getting long or short. Based on
they're getting long or short those options based on, you know, flows that are coming to them. You know, so one of the concerns was, gee, you know, if the dealers are hedging against these options, if you go out to a 30-day option and a dealer sells you a call or sells you a put, you know, then they're short that exposure and they will go hedge themselves typically in the underlying, either in the futures or in the cash. And so, you know, periodically there will be circumstances where there can be a big chunk of option that is going to expire and the dealers need to unwind whatever their hedge was. And that can lead to either buying or selling of the underlying in a way that can potentially move the market. That by, you know, from every expert I know, they don't really have the ability to do that zero DTE, you know, today's expiry. And so to the extent that they're hedging with other zero DTE and kind of canceling out some of the noise. Although, you know, every once in a while we get one of these days where you look at the price action and you say, well, you know, I go back to the days when all that shit was happening on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. And, you know, you went to Joe and you traded with Joe. Well, obviously, Joe's been replaced by a computer because some of the price action you see these days is just inexplicable, except for algorithms, you know, trying to beat the crap out of each other.
Do you feel like it's had any impact on the underlying prices, or is the tail wagging the dog, or is that it hasn't been around for long enough? We're just looking at a market that's sort of done one thing since they've come in.
You know, I we don't really know yet. I tend to believe that, you know, the derivative tail, as it has gotten bigger and bigger and bigger, you know, I live in a part of the country where we have a lot of alligators around. And the one thing you don't ever want to do is get hit by the tail of an alligator. You know, it can be as destructive as their teeth. And I can't help but believe that, you know, we're kind of creating this Frankenstein monster of option flows that will wag the dog at some point in time. And you know, if you're hedging with 0, 1, 2, 3, 4 day to expiry options and some tsunami comes in, you know, you got to get further out on the expiry, on the term structure to hedge, you know, a big event. And so, you know, what some people are concerned about is that what we're going to see is whenever this unknown unknown becomes known, there's going to be, you know, a giant flood of action out to 30 days and 3 months and whatever, you know, time frame people think they need in order to protect themselves. And you could see, you know, VIX and other measures of implied volatility just kind of go through the roof again.
Let me just give a shout out to the listeners and then let's come back and talk about what happened in volatility last year. So, Peter Tikva, Israel, what's up? Always first in the house. San Diego, Valparaiso, Nashville, Dead Cat Gully, New South Wales, you and me both, brother. Menomonee Falls, Wisconsin, Santa Monica, Castleford, England, Santo Domingo, Dominican Republic, Milton Keynes, Mosfellsbar, Iceland, sorry. Oh, there's another one here. Some bangers in here, JT.
Sound it out, Toby.
Tromsø, Norway.
Who are these people?
Bangalore, India. Beverly. Netherlands, good one. Tallahassee, Kansas City, Kennesaw. Vancouver, Durham, London. Jupiter, Old Ocean. Harrington, what's up? Brandon, Mississippi. Jim, you said we were a little bit subdued last year in volatility.
You know, I
in your presentation.
Yeah, I referred to it in the presentation that the title page said nothing burger. and, you know, if you look back at what happened last year, once we got through the little March meltdown with the regional banks, with SVB and First Republic and such, there really just wasn't a lot going on. And, you know, kind of dubbed it the year of no fear. We had VIX get back to levels that we hadn't seen since before COVID, right? So kind of 3+ year lows, realized volatility in the S&P, very low. You know, some of the highlights, number of days that VIX was above 20, you know, was tiny compared to the last 3 years. We hadn't seen that kind of stuff since 2019, really. I think the S&P had plus or minus 2%, you know, twice last year. So there just really wasn't anything going on. One of the other things, you know, if you go back to 2022, which was a year when everybody was just really pissed off at the VIX, right? Because you had stocks going down, you had bonds going down, and hedges didn't work for a damn.
Yeah, what happened there? Like, what's your diagnosis of that?
So let me put it as simply as possible, right? If you have a straight line that goes from lower left to upper right, that's your perfect investment, and it has zero volatility. If you have a straight line that goes from upper left to lower right, you've lost all your money with zero volatility. And what really happened in 2022 was you had market moves that really were just kind of stepwise. And so you really never had the kind of violence that would cause implied volatility to jump. You just had this steady grind lower, this low volatility demolishing the value of your portfolio, whether you own stocks or bonds. But, you know, it was like, okay, every day we're going down 1%. And so where's the volatility? You know, VIX and you know, the vol instruments don't behave well in those environments. You know, if you look at some of the tail hedge ETFs that were out, I like to look at a couple of indices that the CBOE has. One is a put protection index. where you own the S&P and you're buying put protection. The other one is you own the S&P and you're buying VIX calls. And in 2022, those were terrible. They didn't do anything for you. You just were burning option premium. And in 2023, they really didn't do anything for you either. You know, we did have some declines in 2023 in the market, right, into the fall. Again, the declines were of the nature where there just wasn't enough fear to cause those premiums to pay off.
Jim, it seems like is the sort of implicit Fed put seems like would be a pretty big finger on the scale of this. Like, I mean, everyone knows the Fed has their back. So, like, what do I need to like insure myself against? Like, the Fed will insure for me.
Well, and I think that's the attitude that a lot of people have is, you know, the Fed is going to, if we go back to Bernanke, you know, subprime is contained. the Fed is working to contain this, whether it's through the rescue of, you know, the regional banks back in the spring of last year, whether it's trying to walk the tightrope of, you know, what's next for interest rates. Lots of jawboning going on. We'll see. I think, you know, the market still thinks that the right path is for the Fed to cut rates. It's looking less and less likely that, you know, we sure ain't going to get six this year. Are we going to get 5, 4, 3, 2, 1? I don't know.
Do they typically cut when the stock market's at an all-time high and unemployment's at an all-time low? Is that usually the way they do it?
Well, if you look back and, you know...
Don't forget trillion-dollar deficits on top of that.
Yeah, you know, if you look back in time, and obviously it's a small data sample because, you know, the Fed's only been around for 100 years or so. And but when the Fed cuts rates, it's typically because the economy needs relief. And it tends to be too late for the stock market. If you go back to global financial crisis, if you go back to, you know, the internet collapse, if you go back to any time the Fed has cut rates, you know, it's typically in concert with the stock market going down.
Horses already left the barn.
Yeah, the horses already left the barn. And they're, you know, it's like if you look at a chart of, you know, Fed funds rate versus, you know, the 2-year or something like that, you know, the 2-year tells you what direction we're going in, and then the Fed catches up. So, you know, all of these people hollering for the Fed to start cutting rates, you know, it's one of those, be careful, you might not want what you're asking for. Because if the economy is strong, which it appears to be, if inflation is not, you know, if that dragon has not been slain, then they're going to conclude that they can't cut rates yet. So, you know, higher for longer, at least in some form, shouldn't surprise people, but, you know, people like to be surprised, I guess.
Often the term structure has some unusual characteristics about it. So I haven't looked for a little while, but historically, when there's an election coming up, there's often a little bump around the election. Is that the case this year?
There's a huge bump right now, actually. Let me see if I can pull it up. October futures came on the board not that long ago. Right now, and October VIX futures, you know, look out 30 days. So they're looking out beyond the November election. And right now, the September contract is quoted 17.55 and the October contract is 20.
Right.
You know, so that's, you know, like a 2.5 point premium between September and October. So the VIX futures are saying something's going to happen and it's going to, you know, cause some turmoil. Who knows, you know, what's baked into that, but If you want to buy that kind of insurance, and you know, VIX futures are, in some respects, an insurance contract, you got to pay up for it.
Is 20 is about historical average?
20 is, you know, again, 20 is relative to 17 and a half, 20 is high. But in the, you know, in terms of history, you know, 20 is not crazy. Right now, the front end is at about 14. You know, we've seen it lower. You go back to 2017, you know, when we saw spot VIX get below 10 a bunch of times. But that was, you know, the anomaly of our lifetimes, probably.
Pull down the thunder, Jim.
Well, you know, look, nothing would please me more than to have 2017 come back again, because it was a good year. Let's just put it that way.
How many times can we cut taxes?
I can't talk about performance, but it was a good year. To be a volatility trader, go ahead, Jake.
Something I've wondered about with the tail risk products. I find the math actually rather compelling as far as the limiting your downside, the variance, that variance drain as you fall off the cliff, and how hard it is to get back once you do. And then the, you know, Shannon's demon arguments, all those things. Like, I think it's like, it's very compelling, but what I always, it's a little hard for me to wrap my mind around is, when you're buying the premium for it, like you're paying this premium, like why wouldn't that be so expensive as to basically neutralize the, like how, I guess I'm asking, like how properly priced are the premiums in the insurance world?
Well, they're, you know, it's really kind of a seller's market. And so, you know, I think the easiest way to gauge the challenges associated with, you know, a tail hedging strategy is to just pull up a chart of VXX and watch it go from upper left to lower right, you know, and whether it's on a log scale or a regular, you know, it's just what the heck? Why would anybody ever buy that thing? And that's
free money basically up to the other side.
Well, it's free money to be short, except, you know, if you were short that, you know, going into, you know, any one of a number of episodes, the most recent being COVID, you know, you would have been carried out. And so, you know, I've always found it a little confusing is a polite word. That folks in my little pond of volatility traders tend to be on one side or the other, you know, short vol or long vol. And, you know, short vol is picking up, you know, dimes in front of the steamroller and, you know, you're going to get killed in Volmageddon or, you know, and long vol, you're just going to bleed to death before you ever get paid. And there obviously are folks out there who have spent time trying to figure out, you know, how you cut that bleed or how you can be short and avoid the catastrophe. And, you know, and some of us are dumb enough to try to take both sides of the trade, you know, but nobody can time markets, so I must be an idiot. But I do think that if you take kind of a short-term trader, swing trader perspective with some of these instruments, which most people can't do, they either don't know how or don't have the constitution or the focus. but I think, you know, there are some ways to play both sides. And I think playing both sides in some fashion is the only way that you have a chance to get the long exposure when you need it without bleeding to death. You've got to take both sides somehow.
That Taleb Spitznagel style of thing seems to be sell near money, buy the tails. That's sort of the
Right.
Has that worked? I mean, is that a viable strategy and implementation?
Well, you know, Universa, they've done fine. And I think, you know, there are a lot of institutional money managers, you know, think endowments, pension funds, you know, big Goliath organizations that might want, you know, a hedge strategy that's managed by somebody else professionally. And so they might put some money with Universa. You know, I think it was CalPERS who famously got out of it just before COVID.
Yeah, whatever they're doing, you probably want to think about it. You want to do the opposite.
You know, the challenge, you know, and it was funny because Universe obviously put up some great numbers, you know, in COVID, and it was like they made 4 trillion percent. But, you know, but when you actually look at, yeah,
he's
when,
a goat farmer actually, too. They should mention that.
When you actually look at what the, you know, notional exposure was and what the sort of real impact on a portfolio, I mean, it was nice. And so I have nothing, you know, negative to say about Spitznagel and Universa, and it's a strategy that, you know, has validity. You know,
I think
it's
what
really
Mark
just a
would
question.
Say as a counter argument to that was you have to look at the blend of both, let's say 98% long S&P 500 and 2% mm-hmm. hedged, and that there's some magic that happens between the combination of those, and so just taking it in isolation is not really not a fair
right.
assessment.
No, it's not. It's not a fair in either direction, either the bleed or the positive impact of having the long vol exposure, the convexity. And I think that's absolutely right. So, you know, then it's, you know, what is the impact on the overall portfolio of having a 1% or a 2% or a X percent, you know, exposure to that particular strategy? Is that going to get you what you want when that stuff happens? And, you know, for institutional players who are just trying to avoid really bad stuff happening, and who generally are short vol in their portfolios, you know, they own stocks, they own bonds, they own whatever they own, real estate, you know, they're short vol. they probably should have something like that as part of their portfolio, just to give them a little bit of a breath of, you know, air when things get really bad.
When you look at fixes below 20, which is sort of below average, do you think about it like a mean reverting type strategy, or is it a thing that has momentum? Like, you say you're swing trading, is that sort of suggesting that it's got some short-term momentum characteristics? Like when it's cheap, it stays cheap. When it gets expensive, it gets more expensive.
Yeah. And, you know, I look at VIX. VIX is nice, but you can't buy or sell VIX, right? So what you're really, and again, there are 1,000 ways to express a view of volatility, you know, option markets, futures markets, you know, index options, VIX options, blah, 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 blah. You know, I think that if you think about it this way, most of the time, things are on an even keel and you would prefer to be short volatility. Owning stocks, you know, is going the right direction. And that means that shorting VIX futures will, you know, go the right direction. You know, if spots at 14 and the futures are at 16 and you sell the future and, you know, when it expires at 14, you know, you've collected that $2 and you do it again.
Now, is that hot new ETF, XIV?
Indeed. That's exactly right. And okay. and my friends have replicated it with SVIX, a better construction, a little more durable, and actually has a little bit of a hedge built into it. But yeah, that's, you know, so most of the time being short volatility in one form or another, you know, works. And the thing about doing it in this VIX futures space is, you know, it's kind of like buying a leveraged ETF, right? So you could buy the Qs, or you could buy the 2XQs, or the 3XQs.
Yeah, let's go.
Let's go. And, you know, and there's some volatility associated with doing that, you know, but if everything stays going in the right direction, you come out ahead. And so, you know, shorting volatility through the VIX futures is really akin to that. You know, you're getting a multiplier effect versus, you know, owning the sort of underlying plain vanilla indices. And so, you know, you could look at it and say, I don't want 100% of my portfolio doing that, but maybe, you know, as a little juicer, you know, you take some short volatility exposure. But, you know, when the thing falls off the edge of the table and heads to the floor, you're heading to the floor, you know, much faster than the S&P or the Qs. And so, you know, you either have to be position sized to deal with that, right? You got 2% of your money in Universa, not 20%. Or you have to have a switch that says, okay, I don't like the current condition of this market. You know, I've got my little signals that tell me it's safe or it's not safe. And if the signals say it's not safe, then you get out of the position. And, you know, so again, there are a whole bunch of different ways you could conjure that up. But, you know, I would contend that most of the big surprises that we've seen in our lifetimes, you know, have not been as surprising as, you know, people want to portray them. And that includes like the 87 crash. It includes COVID. It includes, you know, August of 2011, August of 2015.
But you know COVID was going to happen before.
Yeah.
Well, was you it, didn't
there,
know.
There was an inversion. There was an inversion.
Yeah. You 10-3 inverted. That's how you would know.
Well, you know, look, you none of us knew much of anything, you know, but if you were reading, if you were paying attention and, you know, and I can go back and, you know, show you a little breadcrumbs that said, you know, which side do you want to be on? Do you want to be on the side that says everything's okay, full speed ahead? Or do you want to be on the side that says, hey, you know, maybe we should just take a beat here? And how you express that, again, is, you know, everybody's different. Some people would say, I'm just okay, I'm going to put a little hedge on, or I'm going to take some exposure off. And other people would say, get to the other side of the boat. You know, we are loading up. And, you know, if this thing goes the way I think it's going to go, we're going to make, you know, 10 years worth of money in a month. And some people did that.
Jim, we usually do veggies, which is Jake's got some learnings for us, brought to us from the Sacramento International Airport today. So there'll be a little bit of background noise, but, and then when we come back, we'll get some predictions from you. Since COVID was predictable, let's predict the next thing.
Yeah. So this week's veggies are about this book by, it's a short little missive from Jim Collins called Turning the Flywheel. And they're in it, he has this thing called Bergelman's Trap, which we'll get into. But just talking about flywheels more generally, they're these mechanical devices which store energy in the form of rotational momentum. And it works because of a principle called the conservation of angular momentum, taken some physics classes. But basically, like, torque can be applied to a flywheel to cause it to spin, and it increases its momentum. And this stored momentum can then be used to apply torque to any rotating object, so most usually like in machinery or motor vehicles. And a flywheel inherently smooths out these small deviations in the power output of a system. So the stored energy inside of it can, like, donate if there's a drop in the power input, and conversely, it can absorb excess power that's being generated in the form of rotational energy. So, interesting that ones made out of steel are generally limited to a max rate of a few thousand RPMs, but they have these high energy density flywheels that are made of carbon fiber composites and actually use like magnetic bearings, less friction, and it allows them to revolve at speeds up to 60,000 RPMs, which is kind of cool. I mean, flywheels have been around forever in the form of like spindles and potter's wheels, 3,500 years ago, 3,500 BC, they had a rudimentary potter's wheels. So this idea of like moment of inertia is another physics term, and it plays the same role as kind of in rotational kinetics as like mass plays in a linear world. So they both characterize a resistance to change, right? Like it's resisting you doing something to it. Sometimes you want a high moment of inertia. So like, for instance, a tightrope walker, they use this long rod as a balance, and it's because it has a very high moment of inertia. Like it takes a lot of energy to like make it move rotationally. And so then it provides this, it resists rotation, which gives the walker balance. And that's why they're able to like kind of keep their balance better as they're walking across the tightrope. Sometimes you want a low moment of inertia, and to improve maneuverability, combat aircraft are designed to have to minimize their moment of inertia. This is what a lot of the work of like John Boyd was centered on. And I know, Toby, you sent me some stuff on that, which is really interesting. So back to this book about flywheels in the business context. And Collins is saying that like basically every good business has some flywheel to it that gathers momentum as it's spinning, as the business gets spun up. And what he calls like strategic compounding. And so of course, like Amazon is kind of like, everyone has heard this one, is probably the most widely discussed, but here's a rough sketch of Amazon's flywheel. You start with lower prices on more offerings, which then increases customer visits, which then attracts more third-party sellers, which then expands the store's offerings, which then grows revenue per fixed cost, which then allows them to lower prices. And then we start the whole flywheel over again. So you're feeding energy into each one of these things, each component, and it's getting the spinning faster and faster. One way of thinking, like you should be able to say at the end of each little consequence, like you almost can't help but. So for instance, like Vanguard has a flywheel that they've been turning now for almost 50 years. They offer low-cost mutual funds, which you almost can't help but deliver good long-term returns. Which you almost can't help but build customer loyalty, which you almost can't help but grow AUM, which you almost can't help but create economies of scale, which you almost can't help but lower costs, right? So we're back up to the top of the flywheel again. And so this thing just spinning. And so companies that have survived for a long time often have to discover new flywheels to build along with the ones that they have going. Of course, everyone knows Amazon and going, having both AWS and retail operations. But there's lots of other examples, like 3M, they added adhesives like scotch tape to their abrasives like sandpaper, Apple PC to the iPhone. Merck actually started out as a chemical company and ended up going into pharmaceuticals. Disney started with animated films, ended up in theme parks and merchandise. And then maybe one that's interesting, a lot of people haven't heard, but like Circuit City, which was sort of like a poster child for bankruptcy and, you know, a shitty business eventually. They actually created CarMax before going bust, and they applied all the same things that they understood about Circuit City to selling cars, and that's where CarMax evolved from. So this brings us into what I teased at the beginning, this thing called Bergelman's Trap. And Robert Bergelman was a Stanford Business School professor, and he observed that the greatest danger in business and life lies not in outright failure, but in achieving success without understanding why you were successful in the first place, right? So if you're kind of right for the wrong reasons, that's like the worst case scenario. And it's quite likely that if you can't explain the flywheel of a company that you believe is a superior business that you're investing in, you might not understand it well enough to consider it within your certain competence, and you're therefore following into Bergelman's trap. So a little section on flywheels that you can look for, and hopefully helps deepen your understanding a little bit of like why some businesses are grow to be so dominant.
That was brilliant. Thank you. Righto, Jim. You're back in the block.
How do I follow that?
Very easily.
We're going to do some predictions now.
Now I've got flywheels in my head the rest of the day. I got to look for my flywheel.
When you look out at the vol, or just generally, what do you see? What does it look like to you now?
So I think you know, I think about all the stuff that could have an impact on markets. You know, we've had this war in Ukraine for 2 years now. We've got, you know, international intrigue in the Middle East and the Far East, and this election coming up. I think the one thing that I feel confident about is that that October VIX futures contract is wrong.
Yeah, it's either way too cheap or way too expensive.
Yes. And I don't know, and I'm not taking any bets at the moment. But, you know, I've kind of got one eye attached to that, saying, you know, at some point between here and there, we're going to be fed some additional information that's going to suggest that you either need to strap your helmet on, or you need to, you know, increase your equity exposure.
I mean, Jim, AI can solve all that. VIX is going to 9.
Yes. We didn't talk about it. We didn't talk about AI with zero DTE.
Is it trading zero DTE?
I'm sure
NVIDIA is.
I you know, look, we've got algorithmic trading, you know, doing everything, and I keep getting pitched, you know, on how algorithms are going to solve all my problems. I subscribe to one of Jim O'Shaughnessy's favorite views, which is that the last frontier of arbitrage is human misbehavior. And I changed from being an econ major to a psychology major after the econ guy said assume rational behavior.
Yeah, those should be the same degree, really. But unfortunately, they're not.
Well, you know, more so than they were back in the day.
That's true. We have behavioral economics now.
Yeah, but, you know, so I guess I would be a bit surprised if this is another nothing burger year in the vol space. But it's possible. And you know, again, I've got my eyes on that October contract to as the tell. You know, and obviously we're going to get some news items between here and there. we're going to have a couple of political conventions, couple of. So,
I was kind of surprised to see Buffett say that he thought that today's markets were more of a casino than when he was first started out.
Well, I think that's interesting. I would say that, you know, it's a little bit like sports betting, right? You know, you can now bet in the middle of a game on, you know, the next play. You know, how far is the punt going to go? I mean, it's nuts, and it's very high twitch. And some of that high twitch has, you know, entered the markets, you know, whether it's the meme stock trading, you know, the Robinhood platforms, you know, certainly AI and machine learning is being applied to markets to try to, you know, figure out, you know, how to buzz in faster than your competitor. How to take that position in front of somebody else. And so, you know, I think that there certainly are aspects of markets that are much more casino-like than they were, you know, back in Warren's earlier days when, you know, he could take his time to find, you know, some inefficiency and slowly build a position before anybody knew he was doing it. But,
then you have Einhorn, on the other hand, saying that he can't get a repricing on any of the things that, you know, he used to buy at a 10 PE and get back to a 15. And now he has to buy a 5 PE and hope that they do buybacks. So on the other hand, it's like kind of inefficient in the other direction compared to what, you know, all the gambling.
Yeah. I leave the fundamentals to smart people like you guys and David Einhorn. I think that for what I'm trying to do, price is you know, the arbiter. And it's not to say that, you know, price is always right. But, you know, how many times have we seen price stay wrong for an enormously long period of time? I think
no
Buffett's, you know, it's hard to argue with Uncle Warren on an observation like that. You know, as our buddy Rudy Havenstein, I think just about every day he's got a post referring to the casino.
Casino closed. Jim, I just read Hussman's interim comment, and he's bearish, but he's been bearish for a while. But he seems to think that there's the reason it's an interim comment is because there's some very near term volatility, I think, is the way that he would characterize it. Do you, if you read that and you want to rush out to sort of hedge yourself, or what's the sort of smart way of doing that, given where the VIX is relative to the VIX futures and the options and all that sort of, is it an expensive?
This is not investment advice. Also, Toby.
It's not, but I'm going to be writing down the answer.
Thanks, Jake. You took the words right out of my mouth. You know, the grail, right, is that convex place to be, right? Where is the convexity? And right now the convexity is in the wings, right? If you look at measures of skew, if you look at what deep out of the money hedging costs, it's very low, you know. So the answer would be, you know, as far out of the money as you can be comfortable, and then, you know, figure out what kind of position size would achieve the objective you hope to achieve. But, you know, that's what I'm seeing right now, is that, you know, again, the cost to hedge remains historically low.
The black swan insurance is relatively cheap right now.
Relatively cheap, yeah. And does that mean it's going to, you know, what that means is that if something really does rock the world, that's going to have a good payoff. The flip side is, and so if you're not paying a lot for that protection, then you also can, you know, comfort yourself that you haven't, you know, bet the ranch and, you know, then found out that, you know, the bet was a waste of time and your ranch is gone.
It's been a little while since I've lost money in the wings, so that'll be fun. I go and throw some money away there.
One more time for old time's sake.
Jake and I used to keep each other going when we were buying tail insurance and it wasn't getting paid off. We egged each other on. Thank God that finally finished.
Well,
didn't ever get paid.
As part of my 2023 presentation, you know, I showed two ETFs that are designed to provide tail hedges, and I did not identify them. You know, and the purveyors of said ETFs are friends of mine. So I didn't want to
criticize by category.
I didn't want to incur any more wrath than necessary, but you know, it just goes to show that, you know, this is a hard game, and you need to really kind of invest some time and effort to figure out how you want to play the game, if you want to play the game, Because again, there are a bunch of different ways, you know, if you're nervous, take some exposure off the table. You know, that's sort of the easiest way. Now, oh, but Jim, there are tax consequences. I don't want to, you know, recognize gains. Okay, fine. You know, then, you know, sort out another way to do it, but recognize that, you know, they ain't no free lunch.
The damn fixed call options. The problem was they're European. So then we actually be in the money at one point, but not when it was time to close them.
Yeah, I've done that a few times.
So, you know, again, not a recommendation, but, you know, there are pretty vibrant option chains on UVXY and VXX. You know, so if you don't like VIX options, then, you know, you can go to the ETFs and get similar exposure in options that you can close out whenever you feel like it. And there are a lot of really smart people who are active, you know, in those option chains. Some, you know, very
that's where you want to be, competing with the really smart people.
Well, or just try to get on the horse that they're already
on the same
horse.
Yeah. Speaking of which, there was a trader, and I forget who used to follow this, somebody on Twitter or Zero Hedge or someone like that, used to follow the Fitty set. Do you remember Fitty? He used to come in wasn't male.
Yeah,
female,
well,
but
Fitty's
in
been
huge size.
Yeah, Fitty's been identified. Okay. It's a very large UK money manager, and who, you know, gigantic equity portfolio that, you know, was looking for hedges here and there, some of which paid off and some of which didn't. But
do you know how they did overall in that trade?
You know, I don't. I mean, there's some stuff out in the on the interwebs making reference to it. There are some people who've, you know, who suggest that they've done the math and figured out that they either made or didn't make any money. But, you know, again, that's a classic case where, you know, it's not some hedge fund guy speculating with, you know, long fixed call positions. It's somebody hedging a portfolio just with enough size that, you know, it got noticed.
Jake, we had a request to repeat the name of the Bergelman. Was it Bergelman? Can you spell that?
Yeah. Bergelman's Trap. It's B-U-R-G-E-L-M-A-N.
Bergelman's Trap. Thanks very much. Jim, we're coming up on full time. If folks want to follow along with what you're doing or get in contact, what's the best way of doing that?
The, you know, an easy way is to track me on X, the Twitters, at Vixologist. You can also find me, you can Google Ballast Rock, B-A-L-L-A-S-T, Rock. In Charleston, South Carolina, there are a bunch of cobblestone streets that are not cobblestones. They are rocks that came out of the old sailing ships that may have been leaving cargo of different sorts in Charleston Harbor. And back in those days, you know, you needed to weigh down the ship if it didn't have cargo. So they used ballast rock that resembles cobblestone, but that's where our name came from.
I did wonder about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. Jim Carroll, Ballast Rock, and the Vixologist on Twitter, thank you very much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
And we'll be back next week, everybody. Same.